This episode of the Birdshot Podcast is presented by Onyx Hunt, the number one GPS hunting app, and Final Rise, premium quality, made in USA hunting vests and field apparel, and Upland Gun Company, custom built and fit handcrafted Italian shotguns. Hey, listener, it's your host, Nick, here with a quick message before the show. If you enjoy this episode, learn something new, or just feel like helping us out, please consider following the show, subscribing on your favorite podcast platform, leaving us a 5-star review, or sharing this episode. All of these things greatly help the Birdshot Podcast and allow us to reach more and more listeners just like yourself. I would appreciate you taking just a minute to do any of those things. And if you really love the show and you want to contribute above and beyond what you already do by listening, subscribing, and following, you could consider becoming a Patreon contributor, which gets you some exclusive discounts and promotions, some bonus content from time to time. You'd be eligible for any and all Patreon giveaways. And last but hopefully not least, I will send you some Birdshot Podcast can coolers and stickers as a thank you from me for your support of the show. You can learn more and sign up for that at patreon.com/birdshot or click the link in the show notes to this episode. Thank you very much for listening. And with that said, I hope you enjoy this episode of the Birdshot Podcast. Well, I'm heading to the cabin later today, and I haven't been there. Gosh, I don't know. I might not have been there since last fall. So the boys and I are loading up the truck, and we're headed there this afternoon, Levi.
That's fantastic. Are you guys going to go do some fishing too?
So we will. I don't know how the fishing will be. You can catch bluegills all year. I haven't even really thought about it from a regulation perspective. The bluegills probably aren't in the ice. I don't know how long ago the ice went out, but I'm sure the water is still cold, but we'll see. The main objective is just to get down to the cabin. It's going to be a nice weekend, and we've got some patterning to do on the turkey shotgun.
I bet. And so is that your cabin's in Wisconsin, correct?
Correct.
Yep. So do you have to draw for turkey tags there, or is it over the counter?
We do, and I'm calling that we're rolling into the show here. So welcome back. Welcome back to the Birdshot Podcast, Levi. So you got to draw a tag. I drew a tag last year, so I'm a non-resident. And based on my experience with this, which dates back a handful of years, I don't know when I'll draw another tag for that particular zone. It's in the northern part of the state. It's kind of the least amount of tags. So my odds as a non-resident are not very good from what I understand. So it might be another year or two before I draw another tag, but I did draw one last year and was successful. So I've got a tag for another area further south in Wisconsin where you can kind of get them over the counter. So I've got that hunt coming up in May. And then I was going to ask you about turkey hunting anyways, but, I was planning to wait to do my turkey season kind of second half of May, because that, again, my short experience doing it, that usually works out fairly well for these northern areas of Minnesota and Wisconsin that I hunt. But based on the weather forecast next week and some recent hunting reports, and we've kind of had an earlier spring, I think I'm going to do my elective season next week, which will be, we're recording this today on April 25th, so I don't know when that episode will air, but it looks really good. And I was talking to my friend shot a bird earlier this week, and I was talking to a landowner that I've got access to hunt on, and he said the birds were gobbling all day on Wednesday. So I'm getting pretty fired up.
Yeah, that's fantastic. It's turkey hunting is such an interesting thing. I'm definitely very turkey curious. So I've had very minimal experience in the past. I've hunted turkeys a couple times, had one really, really cool experience, kind of really probably spoiled me and ruined me, but like shot a bird with a bow at 4 yards. Really nice.
Oh, you did?
Oh yeah. And got to see the full show, head turning colors, all the sounds, all like incredible
4 yards.
Experience. Since that time, I just haven't really gotten back into it, but Seth is always kind of goading me a little bit to to get interested and watching his adventures and having conversation with him and kind of trying to learn more about their behavior and, you know, drawing parallels really to the only thing that I can compare it to is elk hunting. And I don't think there's similarities, right? So you're having conversations with a critter, which is super cool. But just, he's been talking to me about, you know, behaviors of hens and toms and right now being paired up with their hens and then how they're reacting. And then in my mind, again, my only frame of reference is talking about elk that are in the same kind of situation. So it's been really fun to learn from him and to pick his brain. And I'm thinking that I might make a trip up and go let the master Seth kind of show me his ways. So that'll be fun. I'm excited about that.
Yeah, you mentioned that when we were chatting a few days ago, and I was going to ask you about it today because you refreshing me, that was kind of I knew that you had said something to me in the past, like, yeah, you know, you understand, like, people get excited about it, but it's not something that you're all in on. And I know you to be the kind of person, you know, when you're all in, as you are with upland hunting, and most of us listeners are as well, probably. But I didn't know that I was going to ask you today if you had been turkey hunting. So you obviously had the show, and then just sort of where you were at and if you were actually going to possibly go hunt with Seth. But yeah, do you elk hunt every year?
Yeah. Yep. I'm fortunate enough to be able to do it every single year. It's changed a lot. Definitely the earlier parts of my life, you know, the big game space was a major driver. I've been fortunate enough to hunt most of the West for multiple different species, everything from, you know, antelope to mountain goats, and everything in between. And anymore, it's most of my big game hunting is strictly meat procurement. I don't archery hunt elk anymore because of the time investment, and the time that I have to then look at those dogs when I leave for a lot of time. So, I'm able to get cow tags here. And this last year, I had a meeting the morning before it opened and was up on the mountain and knew a spot where those elk go through that time of year. And took a Teams call up there, and sure as heck, they were going through the same spot. So the next morning I was able to clear my schedule and go out, and I had killed an elk by 8:30 and had her backed off the mountain by noon and in the cooler by 2:00. So yeah, nice. It was a one day endeavor and full freezer for the winter and made mama happy for sure.
Do you still have elk in the freezer, or is that gone by now?
We still have some. Okay. We're definitely getting low. My wife and I, we can, one elk will take care of us pretty close for a year. Otherwise it's like some variation of, so I might shoot a whitetail that year and maybe I get lucky to pull a antelope tag in Wyoming or here in Idaho. And, you know, it's either two of like the smaller size deer species or one elk. Usually it gets us right up against it where I definitely need it, but.
Yeah. Yeah. The meat procurement department, it's been really been on my mind the last few years, but I have not found a way to carve out the time to do it. I've got maybe some trying to think about like the most efficient way that I could possibly get a whitetail for me. That would be, you know, that's pretty much the only option around here, and have got a few, but September rolls around and obviously I'm thinking about bird hunting and I'm going out west and chasing sharptails. And I get back here, I'm starting to realize, like, I know that I'm not really missing a lot in the grouse woods September, and gosh, the last few years, I mean, it feels like even the first half of October, it's like so warm and thick, and you know, you live for those later season days, but you want to get out there and get in the groove and, you know, get ready for the primetime days. But there's some time in there where I could probably take advantage of one of these opportunities and maybe go get some venison, but I haven't done it yet. So the dogs are probably happy that I have it, I guess.
Yeah, I totally understand. Any opportunity that I get to be behind dogs, I have a hard time walking away from that. It just brings so much more joy to my life. But I try to have a little bit of forward thinking and knowing that, you know, it sure is nice to have the meat in the freezer. I would think that in your area, do you guys, you know, it seems like a lot of those Midwestern states have multiple doe tags that you can get for one buck tag, or you've got to shoot a couple does before you get a buck tag, or, you know, there's different rules and regulations for every state, but do you guys have something like that to where you could go out and maybe even contact a landowner? I think a lot of times if you're like, hey, I just would like to shoot a doe or two, it'd probably be pretty simple.
So you're thinking in exactly the way that I would be thinking. And I think to be successful, it probably would have to be that landowner connection, which I have one, a friend of mine. He's got a smaller piece of property that could potentially be huntable. But that's the thing, in the northern parts of the states where I'm at, the last handful of years, the deer population hasn't been what it was in the early 2000s. Say, so doe tags are actually pretty limited. Outside of one opportunity that I have is there is a city archery hunt in Duluth that you can relatively easily, I shouldn't say, I mean, there's a few hoops you got to jump through, certifications and this, and not to mention I've never killed a deer with a bow, so that's a whole other deal, but there is that. But outside of the city, the doe tags are not as easy to come by. So that's kind of the thing, is like, do I go through the whole rigmarole of going out and doing the rifle season and hopefully I get a buck coming by? I mean, I love deer camp. It's just something that hasn't been a priority for me. Boys are getting older. Maybe we'll get that reestablished someday. We'll see. But I do need to keep sort of massaging the venison procurement, landowner connection, maybe look for that sweet spot opportunity. So if anybody's out there listening in the area, they've got an opportunity, get in touch with me.
Yeah, it'd be such a neat experience for your boys too, to be able to take part in that. You know, I think you and I have talked about this in the past, to how I definitely look up to a lot of the Midwestern deer camp traditions. I think it's a really, really neat experience. It's so different than what my experience was. I know there's people in the West that have probably very similar experiences to what has been described in your area, but it just wasn't part of my fabric at all. So I just look at it as this amazing opportunity. I can remember being a kid, and the closest thing I can think of to it was, you know, like, I had a buddy that had a cabin, and it was on a place that has, you know, relatively decent deer hunting and some good chuck running opportunities. And it was always like they went every year for the first week, because in that state, deer season would open and then it would roll in a week later into chucker season. And there was a lot of camaraderie and excitement. And I can just remember being, you know, 11 years old, 10 years old, 12 years old, and sitting at a local diner on the way there, and just the excitement and all of that mm-hmm. that goes with it, that really stokes the fire for people who are just getting started and really continues to help the candle burn as we go along in the process. And yeah, to be able to introduce your boys to that, I think would be pretty powerful.
Yeah. Yeah. They're showing, you know, they've had some exposure now, and they're showing a lot of interest in sort of all things outdoors. So of course, nothing makes me happier. And it gives me a reason to get out there and go do things and have some fun and take a different approach and check my own attitude and, you know, why are we out here? And it's a lot of fun. It's been a really, really good experience for me thus far. And we're just getting started, man. So
yeah, I love some of the videos that I feel very, very fortunate that you'll send me every now and again, because they absolutely just brighten my day of you getting out with the boys and their enthusiasm and excitement for all of it is just so infectious, and this incredible reminder that we all need sometimes, right? Because we get pretty tunnel vision and focused on, you know, whether it's the dog work or looking at habitat or whatever it may be. Just to take a minute and to look around at how just marvelous all of it is. And their enthusiasm is, it's incredible. I love it. So thank you for sharing that stuff with me.
Oh, you bet, man. I appreciate being able to share it with you. It's one of those things where you don't want to force all of my photos and videos of kids on everybody. I know I was once, before I had kids, you're in a little bit different state of mind, but I know you're open to that. And
Oh, I
yeah, I
love
think I
it.
sent you a video of Jack in the blue pack, and I've been, man, I have gone on so many hikes now with him. It was first my older boy Hunter. We got that when he was kind of almost growing out of the backpack size, but then my younger son Jack, he's been in there so much, but he's getting there. I mean, it's good workout for me. Like it's a good ruck bringing him along every day, but we're getting to the point where that pack, it's a Kelty, I call it the blue pack. I don't know what it is. It's a Kelty backpack. But that was given to me. I actually did a little trade. My buddy Ted Summer, he used it for his boys. He gave that to me. Now my boys have been in it and he used it a lot. We've used it a lot. So I'm now thinking I'm gonna have to find somebody to pass that along to, pay it forward. Because the pack is, I mean, it's a champ. Like it is held up through a lot of rucks and hikes, and it has a lot of life left in it. So I'm gonna have to pass that on and let somebody else's kids go for hikes in the woods with it, hopefully.
Now, again, I love seeing that stuff. I feel like Jack's probably the only person that I'd connect with and has the same level of enthusiasm that I do. Because I still have that same childlike enthusiasm too. And just getting to be out. I mean, we dream about it all summer long, right? We just got done talking about how it's hard to get away and do anything else. And I totally get it. Even when conditions aren't good, or you're like, there's every reason I should go do something else. But to get to put a shotgun in your hands and run behind your dogs, it's just like, I don't know. I have the same level of enthusiasm that he has, so I love it.
Well, speaking of camp experiences, you did get a taste of grouse camp a little bit last fall. Let's rewind a little bit and tell me about your first trip to Great Lakes grouse country. What do you remember? What do you want to forget? Ticks maybe.
It's funny you bring that up because knowing me well, you know that I have a incredible aversion to ticks. I'm terrified of them. There was a lot of research done prior to going up there. Much the same, I'm sure, as some people have in thinking about snakes when they come out west, but you
I
know, it
think it's
becomes your
probably
norm.
exactly the same way I think about snakes.
And you know, anytime something is outside of your normal, it can seem a little intimidating, or you just want to make sure that you're well prepared and taking care of these dogs that we love so dearly and yourself, because the threats are real. But there's no question about it. No one can speak to that better probably than you. So the trip as a whole was absolutely incredible. The whole time I was there, felt like I was in wonder. There's no doubt that some of that was fed by the romance of stuff that I've read, and which I love to dig into. You know, I got Mark Parman's two of his books right here, and like I'm infatuated with it. And the ruffed grouse is something that has became near and dear to my heart really in the last few years, and has made me feel like a beginner again. And I'm someone that's constantly wanting to learn and grow and get better anyway, and being able to have this new opportunity and then go to a place where I kind of have some of my own knowledge that I've gained in a completely different landscape, and then be able to take it and try to figure out the difference in my own knowledge I've gained and what I've read and what I've learned and what I've talked to people who get to do it all the time like you. It was incredible. There was nothing that I would want to forget. I didn't
Good.
find it. Again, my sample size is small, and I got to be there at a time when most of, oh, it wasn't all, the leaves weren't all the way down. I was there the first part of October.
Yeah, early October.
And definitely the days were warm, but the, you know, nice cool mornings, and I was able to find birds. Which, you know, made me feel really good. I went into it pretty confident that I would be able to. I know that my ability to read covers is not going to be like people that are there all the time and experience it. I definitely noticed right off the bat that my Western mentality of, you know, just go, was not very effective. Being able to look at small covers and hunt those covers, and then maybe drop back to the trail and then figure out, you know, continuing on until you found another piece of cover to dive in, was completely a different world for my dogs and myself. Where it's usually a drop the tailgate and it's a 2 to 3 hour, You just go. You just keep hiking. Yeah. And I found myself spending lots of time in marginal cover because I would get into these pieces that would be pretty good. And the next thing I know, I'm out of it and the dogs are still going. And yeah, that was the challenge of something that I would definitely change when given the opportunity to go back again. It's just being able to exercise maybe a little bit more patience and curb the enthusiasm a little bit and not just make it a numbers and miles. Because out west, it really is. A lot of the landscape that you look at, there's subtle nuances and definitely different habitats that are more productive than others. But a lot of times it's a volume game, right? And from my perception and my limited experience, it looks like there's a lot more knowledge that needs to be applied to specific habitat and covers in your world and ages of cuts and what type of vegetation you're actually seeing. So that was something I learned pretty quick that, you know, was definitely an Achilles heel for me.
Yeah, I like that. I don't know how much, you know, I'm sure I have thought about and talked about when I go out west, how much I appreciate just sort of that openness and you can just kind of roll, you just kind of go, you know, and you take in, I don't know, it's just interesting. You can look and you can see so much more. So you kind of just, maybe you're not making so many little micro decisions because you can see what's ahead of you and you just really feel like you're wandering. Whereas in the grouse cover, you really have to sort of shrink your view. And like, you know, that's where satellite imagery, I mean, it's very, very helpful to help you make some of those decisions rather than trying to look around the tree. I mean, it's hard to make decisions when you can barely see 10 feet in front of you. So having that approach with the satellite imagery, I think is probably something that I lean into. But yeah, from somebody that primarily hunts out west and then takes a trip out here, I could see how that would be kind of eye-opening.
Yeah, it definitely was. But as far as like, you know, being overly thick it definitely was a little bit of adjustment, but it didn't affect me as bad as I thought it would originally. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people are intimidated by it. And I would definitely say, you know, if you've chased rough grouse anywhere out west, the habitat is going to be somewhat similar in the fact that those birds are going to live in thick creek bottoms that are filled with thorn apples. Yeah. And like, that part of it was very similar. But with that said, the North Woods did take a piece out of me. I had a big scab underneath my right eye where I took a branch to the face that was, you know, left a scar for like, oh gosh, it was probably there 8 or 9 months. So until I started to get some sun now with the spring temps. But yeah, it was an incredible trip. I can't wait for the opportunity to get to go back again, just being put in the middle of a situation that is so foreign and so different, watching my dogs try to put the pieces together and finding some limited success. You know, I went there. It was really funny. I really try to curb my expectations, especially in something that is so different. And I kind of felt like, okay, I'm going to be able to have an opportunity to harvest a woodcock, but I, you know, and you guys talk about woodcock as in it's not to take anything away from the bird or anything, but it's kind of like the stepping stone, the beginners. There's a lot of opportunity for dogs and a lot of opportunities for shooters. And that, like, I'm going to be pretty happy if I just am able to move some grouse. And the opposite actually occurred, you know, was able to go home with a beautiful drummer. Was so excited about that. And could not hit woodcock to save my life. So the woodcock evaded me. But I will be back.
So you've never killed a woodcock?
I have never killed a woodcock.
That was really your first chance to?
Yep. And it was funny, you know, we'd just barely gotten started. The very first cover that we parked and went into, I ran my older dog and we didn't get 5 minutes into it. And she locks up on point and I walk up and I'm looking and I'm thinking, you know, it's, you know, the birds ran out ahead of us or whatever. And it's a woodcock. And it gets up and my brain scrambled. It was so different than anything that I've ever seen in the presentation. And I was so hyper-focused on thinking about rough grouse and so excited about rough grouse that my dog was kind of, like I said, she locked up and was pointing, but then it got up and she was like, I don't know what this leg is, you know? And I think my brain did the same thing. I don't even know if the gun ever touched my cheek. I just pulled up and shot, and it was terrible. So I had two or three other opportunities. Well, that's probably being a little bit conservative. I had more opportunities than that, but never could connect on a woodcock. So they were very humbling. I think that they deserve a lot more respect than what it feels like. And I think it's inadvertent. I don't think people are trying to be disrespectful. Again, it's just when you're... Most of you guys have probably had the opportunity. That's where you cut your teeth, right? That was your first introduction. And I think the same thing, it did give me a lot of respect then, our perspective for when you guys come out west and like a covey bird. Because to me, a covey rise on partridge, whether you're talking about huns or chuckers, like my brain has seen thousands and thousands of them to where it doesn't scramble it, but I'm sure it was very much the same feeling. Like, I don't even know what happened, you know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah. What you're describing sounds a lot like me pulling up on a covey of hunts. Basically, I think you nailed it right there. It's just, and man, it's a lot of newness. And if you think about all of the programming and pattern recognition you have in your brain is that sort of Western landscape and Western birds and doing what Western birds do. And then all of a sudden you're plopped into the Northwoods cover and this woodcock's getting up and twittering and twirling. I could absolutely see how that's, you know, it requires a little bit of time to wrap your head around it. I was going to ask too, because last year was, man, it was a strange year for woodcock. Probably, I don't know how many, I stopped tracking woodcock flushes a couple years ago, I think, but just based on sort of like gut feeling, it was dry and warm. And I remember questioning, like, are they just loaded up in a swamp somewhere? Or was it a real bad spring? Are there not a lot of woodcock? I really never got into what I would call a flight of woodcock last year. I know other people did. So it wasn't, my experience wasn't the same as everyone's, but it was a light, very, very light year on woodcock for me last year. And I don't know how many of you guys flushed while you were there, but.
We probably averaged, again, temperatures were getting pretty warm. So we would hunt the mornings and then kind of call it. And I had two dogs. And then a friend of mine, Colby Kerber, was there hunting with me as well. And he didn't have a dog. So we were just running my two dogs. And I bet we would flush 7 to 10 woodcock. Now, not all of those were presenting shot opportunities. Some of those were he was walking off to the side of my dog and he would, you know, walk the birds up. But birds that were handled really well, I would say I would get two or three opportunities a day at like really well handled, should have killed woodcock. But moving probably 7 to 10. And then our grouse numbers were in that like 5 to 7, you know, again, which for me, I did the math a couple years ago, and I think I've gotten a little bit better at even identifying covers out here and have kind of narrowed down the search, but I've been averaging like one flush every 4 miles on rough grouse. So to go move, 5 to 7 rough grouse was like incredible for me.
Yeah. 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 It's all relative, right?
Yep. For sure. Yeah. For sure.
I don't know if
it was a really cool experience.
Sorry. Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know if I've ever looked at my rough grouse per miles, although I do have that data, so I could figure that out. But yeah, that's, again, knowing that you were there in early October and kind of refreshing my memory on like what the conditions were like. I think another friend of mine out of state was there around that same time, dry, warm, but they were finding grouse. And I think you guys had a pretty solid hunt. And obviously, I know you didn't come out there with, expectations of like, you know, making your trip on the number of birds you saw or flushed. You were just happy to get out there and see it and experience. And I know that about you, but sounded like you had a great trip.
Yeah. And, you know, the other additives to the trip, you know, the colors were incredible. I slept in the bed of my pickup and like hearing loons on the lake that we were next to at night and wolves howl. And I'm not a stranger to hearing wolves howl or whatever, but like, it just really cemented that whole Northwoods experience. It was an incredible trip. And I was fortunate enough to be able to hunt North Dakota on the way there, on the way back, to kind of get back to some roots too, which was a lot of fun. But Incredible experience. I would highly recommend it. It's wildly different, you know, and for me, different is a lot of fun like that.
Yeah. Any memorable dog moments from like from the rough grouse? I know you bagged at least one grouse. Any moments really stand out for you from your grouse trip?
The biggest one was honestly probably the very first woodcock. You know, I've heard a lot of people talk about some dogs will point them, some dogs won't point them.
Right.
And all of us were as rookie on woodcock as you could possibly be. I'd never seen one in real life, had no idea. And of course, my dogs hadn't either. And to be able to go out, and I think that was part of the added excitement as well, is that was probably the best look I had. It was in an area of like mature pines. And your guys's perspective wide open,
Yeah, okay.
but to watch my dog go out and just slam on point on a woodcock, and again, never seen a woodcock, and neither had I. It was really, really a special experience for sure.
Yeah, that's cool. You mentioned the Mark Parman books. Which two do you have there? Do you have his new one or are these the older two?
I have three of his. So I have his newer
Oh, okay.
one, which was fantastic. But I read the Grouse Hunter's Almanac. I've read it probably three times. I love
Yeah.
going through it. It's sitting right here. And then I've got a Jim Fergus book here too, The Hunter's Road. But
Oh yeah.
yeah, I really appreciate Mark's work. I really liked Upland Matters. It was a fantastic read.
Yeah, I'm making my way through Upland Matters right now and will likely get Mark and perhaps the artist of the sketches in that book on the show here in the near future. That's kind of the plan. So, enjoying it so far. And yeah, I loved this for I when I first read Mark's, it probably was a Grouse Hunter's Almanac. I didn't know who he was. You know, I hadn't interviewed him on the show, anything like that, and just really enjoyed. I think it was kind of around the time that my parents bought the cabin in Wisconsin, and I was reading some books about northern Wisconsin and familiarizing myself, just kind of immersing myself. And so Mark really writes about just he weaves in history and sort of the natural landscape, and I've always appreciated that about him. So he kind of fueled my love and passion for northern Wisconsin, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
But
I think it's really easy for any of us to appreciate quality writing, you know, but when you're
yeah.
talking about a subject then where someone is able to articulate such reverence and the nuance so well, and really it makes me feel like they're able to take every thought that I have in my head, but I'm not intelligent enough to be able to articulate it. And to be
Yeah.
able to read it, it feels like they've literally got inside my heart and my head and put it on paper. And he's done a masterful job with that. I really appreciate the work that he's done. And Jim Fergus is another one that's just, yeah, it's such a craft and a talent. And I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no doubt. I've had those same thoughts reading Mark's writing and many others. I suppose that's what separates the good ones from the average Joes like you and
That's the truth, my friend. Gosh, I've tried and dabbled in writing, and
I.
every time it's like I walk away from it feeling like I must just have two big boulders inside my head that bang against each other, and like that's about the extent of it for me.
Man, well, it's been 2 years since you've been on the show. Since then, since you were last on and we chatted, you kind of have a new role and you're at Pheasants Forever now. Get us up to speed a little bit. You're like, I think we chatted at Pheasant Fest. You're like 18 months into the working for them, right? Yeah, give us a intro.
Just incredibly fortunate is really what sums it all up, and a lot of gratitude. I'm someone that really dreamed my whole life of having an opportunity of working somewhere in the space, and to be able to work within conservation, and taking this past history experience from a professional standpoint and melding it with my true passions is, really just a dream come true. So I feel extremely fortunate. It was the way that it all just kind of came together was very fortuitous, and saw something in me, fortunately, and gave me an opportunity. So currently I work as a programs manager. My official title is Conservation Leadership Programs Manager. And underneath that, I have three programs that I manage, which is our Journey to Conservation Careers program, our virtual college and career fair, and our national internship program. So prior to coming on with the organization, I spent a considerable amount of time working in the education space and really valued my time there. It was tremendous. I met a lot of wonderful people and got to really grow professionally and personally, and being able, again, to take all that experience and then turn it towards where my heart has always been and apply that knowledge is really just a dream come true. So yeah, I'm super excited. Tremendous organization that's doing unbelievable work all across the landscape. I get to work with super passionate people that care about the work that they're doing. And yeah, it's unbelievable.
Did you step into a role that already existed, or was it a new position?
Initially, there's a little bit of nuance. There was definitely a little bit of a restructure. This role itself was one that had been kind of on the plate of another program manager, and then it kind of changed as we've added some other programs. And just so happened that all kind of happened around the time that I had applied for another position. And when I went through the interview process for that other position, and then received a phone call saying, hey, we think that this would be a tremendous fit, and this is what we're thinking about doing, and kind of going a different direction and being able to leverage some of your past experience. And there's a real need for it within the organization, and we think that you're the right guy to maybe try to drive that forward. So yes, the actual role that I'm in is new with me, although gotcha. Some of the programs aren't all the way new.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I know we chatted about this when I saw you in Kansas City a month or two ago, but you wrote about kind of one component of your job in the, I got to check this, the fall issue, fall 2024, Pheasants Forever Journal. The Journey to Conservation Careers, right? And I was reading that article at sometime this winter before Pheasant Fest, and in the article you sort of talk about, you know, when you were younger, you had this love and passion for the outdoors, as I did, as many of the listeners did, I'm sure. And you thought about, like many people, you know, you hear, you know, if you could align your interests and passion with your career, wouldn't that be a wonderful, wonderful world? But how do I do that? And like your brain took the shortest path to that, and you thought of biologist and conservation officer, game warden, which immediately resonated with me, because when I was younger, having those same thoughts, I don't even know if I thought of biologist. I don't know if that ever really stuck out. Not sure that would be the role for me anyways, but I could only think of, well, if I want to work in hunting, I think I could be a game warden, right? And I even applied to Bozeman, Montana, the university, and got accepted there because they had a conservation officer program. And long story short, I never went out there, never did that. But the point of it being is that's all I could come up with too. And I think you have a little bit different perspective on that now, given your existing role. And one of the things that you do in your role is to try to open up the minds of young folks and to expose them to potential opportunities. So tell me a little bit about your experience and how you thought about it at the time and your perspective on it now.
Yeah, we are very similar in that. You know, I can remember standing on the banks of a small creek that ran through my grandpa's place at the age of, you know, maybe 8 years old, and having a friend over that would be holding an old milk jug and acting like it was a video camera. You know, and we were creating a fishing show. You know, I kind of came into the fold at the time of when outdoor TV really, you know, on TNN was a big deal, and watching people like Bill Dance and Hank Parker and just dreaming of trying to somehow be able to do this every day. And for some reason, you know, I think life happens with all of us. You get deflated. You can't see an avenue in. Again, my mind could only see then once you gain a little bit of maturity and experience that the only opportunities were being a biologist or being a conservation officer, which are incredible positions. And I'm very thankful mm-hmm. that those positions exist. But for one reason or another, they weren't all the way a good fit for me either. So at the time, you know, you go to college and you start looking around, and I always thought about life as trying to find a balance of how much of my life was for sale and at what cost. And at that time, you know, education really fit the bill in that, and being able to have some extended time off and to do the things that I wanted to do in the outdoors, and to still be able to embark upon a life of service and to do something that I felt was very meaningful. And just didn't see if there was any other opportunities even. If they did exist, I missed them because of, you know, teenage kid doing all the extracurricular
things. Yeah, you got other distractions as
right,
well.
Right, right. And I really feel like it's easy to, at least for me, it was easy to kind of get pigeonholed into certain areas based upon what you did in friend groups or whatever. You know, for whatever reason, it takes us away from maybe what we're truly passionate about. And at that time, athletics were a major driver in my life, and you know, kind of followed the path then with a lot of people that are in athletics of looking at education. And so fast forward then to when I've been presented with this opportunity. We're really working hard to be able to create opportunities for young people to see that there is programs out there. There is support, and there is ways to be able to work within a space that are so much different than what the traditional thinking may be. So within our Journey to Conservation Careers program, we were able to work in conjunction with Bellevue University and U.S. Fish and Wildlife to develop a course that really does an incredible job of not only teaching foundational, you know, biology, ecology, upland habitat, talks about the North American model of wildlife conservation, the major funding drivers and the roles that hunters and fishermen play in that in the realm of conservation, but also highlights how each and every one of us can play a role within conservation within different career opportunities. So a great example of that is, you know, you look at our organization and we love to focus on the boots on the ground work, which is incredibly important that our biologists are doing all across the country. But without having a media specialist to be able to continue work to promote and to advocate for, whether it's dollars coming in or communicating our message and our mission to the general public, that wouldn't allow us to be able to do all the work that we are doing. Or without having someone with a strong accounting background to be able to balance the books and make sure that we're headed in the right direction, conservation can't happen. So really just trying to help people realize that if they have an aptitude in another area, I use myself as an example, not that I'm by any means the greatest gift to education, but was just fortunate enough to have a lot of experience and show a little aptitude and an ability to create relationships with people, that we can still take those marketable skills and give you an opportunity to work within a space that you love and affect change on the landscape. So this program is something that's near and dear to my heart. I feel like I'm a living representation of Journey to Conservation Careers, and we're working really hard to get this integrated anywhere that we can, whether it's, you know, I have a community college in Oregon right now that is running it through their natural resources program. I have high schools that have implemented it in their upper level biology classes, or, you know, in their shooting clubs or 4-H. And then we've had people that have reached out that are much like myself that have started in a professional track and have always dreamed of being there, but want to be able to start to create some foundational knowledge. And what's really great about the course too is it's a certificate based course. And in the world of education right now, where there's a tremendous push for us to continue to figure out ways to create opportunities for people that maybe aren't on the traditional college track, but still have some sort of a certificate that will give them a leg up if they are applying for a four-year university or looking at applying for grad school, showing their level of commitment and understanding to these concepts. Or if you're someone that's wanting to apply for an internship, or, you know, maybe your route is through temp work and you're going to work your way up within an agency or an organization, and you're not going to go the traditional college route. This really is beneficial to put on the resume. And the most exciting part is some news that we just kind of had come out in February through a lot of negotiation and a great partnership with Bellevue. We're now able to offer this course free of charge for anybody who wants to participate. So it's something that I couldn't recommend high enough. Again, it's near and dear to my heart as someone that spent their whole life wishing that they could be a part of something this special and being part of making a difference on the landscape, and having that opportunity now and being able to apply my skills is a dream come true.
Yeah, that's awesome. So is it aimed at like young adults, or is it pretty much anybody that's interested in conservation and is just looking for that foundational knowledge?
Traditionally, our aim is definitely in that, you know, 17 to 21 year old kind of range as far as content and rigor. But I would say I've had, you know, 45 year old people take the course that have came back with really great reviews. There's That's people cool. that are just very curious, like yourself and me, on that. Anytime we get an opportunity to be able to maybe grasp on to more knowledge, that's a powerful thing. And the barrier of entry couldn't be any lower. All it takes right now is you to log on and sign up and take the course. I think that one of the greatest pieces of information that people could glean from this, if you're not of the traditional route, or maybe you're not looking at finding a career within the realm of conservation, is that I don't know how many people that are our age that have hunted and fished their entire lives that don't have a good understanding of the economic drivers in conservation, that have never heard of Pittman Robertson, that don't know what Dingle Johnson is. And that tells me that we collectively are missing the mark. Each and every one of us are so fortunate in this country to have an opportunity to go to the polls and exercise our rights. And when we know better, hopefully the goal is we do better. And without having this knowledge prior, I don't always know if we can be as informed as we need to be. So I think there's value at all age levels. But obviously our number one target was to try to create some sort of a conduit for high school and college kids to be able to find a career within the realm of conservation.
Yeah. Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, as a free resource available to anyone at this point, hopefully it's an awesome starting point for a lot of folks. I'm in this state where, you know, I'm beyond college, and, you know, I've ventured way off path here. Like I'm in uncharted territory as far as whatever career path I thought I was going to be on. And my kids they're pretty young. So, you know, I'm thinking into the future, like, you know, what are those conversations going to be like? And to draw back on something you mentioned, I get this sense, like, I'm not right in the thick of it. I don't have kids graduating from high school where we're really thinking about this, but I'm just getting the sense, like, the landscape around education and four-year college and is changing rapidly, it seems, and mix in the other sort of cocktail that we have of technology and everything else going on in the world right now, trying to project 10 years ahead when my oldest son is actually thinking about college or not college. I mean, who knows what the world's going to look like, but at least at this time, you know, having something like this as an opportunity to explore. And I didn't do a whole lot of exploration or deep thinking at the time. And I don't fault, like, kind of like you, like, I don't fault anyone for that. You know, you're a young kid and you just, your perspective changes as you get older and think back on certain things. But, I think, as every parent probably does, you know, you're taking that perspective and trying to help and guide your children in the right way. And, you know, if I were 10 years into the future and my boys were still showing the same sort of interest in outdoors and hunting and fishing, I think we'd definitely be having some conversations about stuff like this and just trying to explore, see what resonates with you, you know?
Yeah, exposure is key, right? And I think that there's definitely some, who knows what the landscape's going to look like in the world of education as we move forward. I think you did a great job of highlighting that. But one thing I think that we do really well is there is more opportunity today than I think there ever was. And opportunity for young people to be able to look into and have resources to go in lots of different directions, whether they're ready to accept that or look for it or whatever it is another question entirely. But I don't think it's all about young people either. I love to joke with people in our organization that I can pretty much guarantee you, I think we have, we're like 700 and something employees now across the nation, and I'm probably the only one with a master's degree in exercise science. So there is opportunity, and if you are passionate enough and you continue to network and continue to grow your portfolio and not only your experience, whether it be in leadership or in whatever your professional aptitude is, and keep that fire lit of whatever it is that you're passionate about, there is opportunities out there for people. And we're just hoping that we can add one more to give people a chance to find their way into this space and something that's very passionate, I'm very passionate about.
Yeah, I would certainly echo that. It's a hopefully if you're lucky, you have a long, prosperous life, and there's always room to grow and develop and continue learning. And just because you're doing one thing today doesn't mean it has to be that way tomorrow. You can slowly change and forge a new path if that's what you want to do.
Absolutely. Well said.
Did you used to be a track and field guy? Like, what kind of athletics were you doing when you were younger?
So I was a wrestler and played
Okay.
football, and but my main sport was actually rodeo.
Oh, really?
I went to college on a full
I don't know
athletic
if I ever knew
scholarship for
that about you.
rodeo. Yeah. I was fortunate enough to win a few state titles in high school and went on to college as a full scholarship. And rodeo was the driving force in my life from the time that I was a little kid all the way. I completely sold everything and hung it up when I was probably 27. So, yeah.
So when you say rodeo, are you doing all kinds of different stuff?
So at different times in my life, definitely. I started out probably like most kids on the pretty traditional track of, riding calves and steers, and then picked up a rope and started team roping a little bit and went to the junior rodeos, and you would do all the events, right? And then started into high school, and at the time I was riding cutting horses as well, and I roped calves and steer wrestled and team roped, and then into college. Steer wrestling and the calf roping. I team roped a little bit as well, but and then the amateur rodeos, I would steer wrestle and rope calves, and then professionally, the calf roping was my main event.
That's what growing up in the Wild West is like.
Yep.
There wasn't a lot of rodeo going on here in Duluth, Levi.
I'm sure. I'm sure. Yeah. It is amazing how I think about the different regions of our country, and I've been fortunate enough to see quite a bit of it. There's some that I still have, and I want to get up to the Northeast. But I think by the time that I was 19, I'd been in every state west of the Mississippi, and it is quite different within our geographic regions where the cultures are equally. We could almost be different countries.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, what else? We talked about the journey to conservation careers, other two programs, anything else going on in your role that you want to highlight? You mentioned you had a film coming up. I don't know if we can tease that here.
Yeah, absolutely. I would be remiss if I didn't talk about our virtual college and career fair too, which is an
Yeah.
annual event that is also free. And this one really serves all side of the house, whether you are, a high school student who is looking to talk to institutions about everything from campus life to prerequisites, tuition costs, et cetera, all the way up to, industry professionals who are looking to find a career within the realm of conservation. There'll be representatives there or booth holders from other NGOs and partners that we have, state and federal agency as well. So It's a really tremendous resource. Official date's not set for this coming year. It will be in December, so there'll be communication coming out about that. But it's a tremendous opportunity for people to, again, log on. It's free to get to talk to these different university representatives or state and NGO and federal agencies. So yeah, that's definitely something for people to be aware of. And then, yeah, we have a film so coming out.
Before you, can I ask you about the career? It's a virtual thing, you said?
Yeah. So people can log on from anywhere.
What's the format? Like somebody from an NGO would be on there as kind of a webinar, and then you could sort of chime in?
We actually have it set up. We have a great platform that allows us to actually have booths. And when you'll see all the booth holders in front of you. And if you want to speak to a representative from there, you'll click on it and it'll drop you into a waiting room. And then they will accept you and bring you in, and you're able to get on via Zoom. It's not Zoom. It's the platform that we use though.
Sure.
Through eCareers. And yeah, you can have conversation. You can upload your resume. We can do full-on job interviews right then and there. So there's a ton of opportunity for people to be able to have face-to-face interaction and speak with all of the booth holders that are there.
That's really cool. I've never participated in anything like with that format, but that's neat the way that you can do that virtually.
Yeah. It creates opportunity where locality doesn't play a role, right? It lowers the barrier and everybody can participate. We've had everything from whole classrooms. I had a teacher then log in and, you know, have some pre-canned questions from her seniors and get to sit and ask those questions and be able to see the faces of the representatives from universities to someone who was actually uploading a resume and wanting to apply for a position that was posted. Booth holders can show positions that they currently have and, you know, people can apply and be hired right there.
Yeah, I think, man, that is really one of the biggest differences from when you and I were, you know, 17, 18, 19, like, I think you think, yeah, you could go move to a city, or, you know, I thought about moving to Chicago and I was in doing finance stuff. And you think about that, but the world has changed so much now where you can really choose a niche if it was conservation or wildlife, biology, that kind of thing. And I just think the exposure and the connectivity, you can really dive a lot deeper in that beyond just thinking regionally or locally. So that's a neat mechanism for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. It goes right back to what, you know, we were talking about, of just people right now have a lot of opportunity. There's tremendous, tremendous resources available and connectivity on all different levels, regardless of your locality, to be able to reach out and to learn, if nothing else, to learn more about being involved and how you can get involved and where you might fit.
All right. I cut you off the film.
Yeah, no worries. So we have a film coming out that was my first stab as a producer, which was an incredible experience and one that was very, very humbling. I was really fortunate to have some great support from our organization and the people on our marketing team to be able to guide me in this. But the premise is we want to continue to tell our story. And we wanted to be able to highlight some of the fringe work that we are doing. I think that we do a really good job of informing people within our core areas of the Midwest with pheasants and quail of the work that's being done on the ground. But we also have a lot of incredible work that's done in fringe areas, whether it's in the deep South or it's out here in the West. And one of the programs that we wanted to highlight along with that, I'll back up a little bit. This goes right into Journey to Conservation Careers. And we wanted to highlight a unique story that someone had of coming into conservation and what that looked like for them and why they chose to work within conservation. Like what is it that sets their heart on fire about not only being part of our organization, but the work that they're doing every single day. So had the opportunity to go down to Mississippi and shoot this film last July with just a remarkable young lady named Olivia Lappin that works on our seed team and then does a lot of work on our right-of-way projects. So what's really cool is she'll take these essentially void areas of quality habitat that have been, big cut swaths for power lines. You can think even roadside edges, and we'll go in and do habitat analysis on them and then start working at putting high quality successional habitat on the landscape that, promotes everything from pollinators to quail nesting ground. And the work that she's doing down there is really, really cool. It's something that not only she's doing, but we're doing in other parts of the country. And again, we just really wanted to tell the story and make sure that people again see that there is a tremendous amount of opportunities within our organization and within the conservation space at large. So she was so gracious to welcome us into her home and to let us follow her around with the camera for a few days. So I'm really excited about that project, and I hope it's something that resonates with people, and it will be released on April 30th. So again, depending upon when this comes out, but really excited about that project, and yeah, I'm excited to see it.
What was the most unexpected challenge of being a video producer?
I had a couple things that were really surprising, and I mean this in no sh way, shape, or form to be disrespectful, but Mississippi was not a place that I'd ever been to before, and was so blown away by the beauty of it. Just an incredible landscape, a place that completely changed. Not that I had a negative image of it, but it was so much more than I ever thought. People were incredible, and the landscape and the diversity that lives there, just the sounds, the amount of life that's there is unbelievable. It's very much akin to me. It made me feel like being in a what I would imagine a tropical rainforest, and all the birds and all the bugs, and like it there was never silence like we have in the West. And it was a remarkable place that I hope to get back to someday. It was incredible. But from the actual work, I think it's really just a general that I didn't fully understand all that goes into a film like that. And having my hand in all parts, from, writing scripts to cutting and the editing portions, and sitting down and really, again, makes me gain a ton of respect for you. I've even run these podcasts of like outlining a direction that you're wanting to go and how to make them cohesive and fluid and make it feel natural, but yet you have a place you're trying to get to. It really is a skill set, and people need to realize that stuff doesn't happen on accident. Like, there's a lot of work that goes into it, and a lot of intentionality. So it was truly an honor to have the chance to be able to be part of all that, and hopefully I did it justice. So we'll see.
Awesome. Well, looking forward to it. And yeah, if the film's out when this goes up, we'll drop a link in the show notes. But Pheasants Forever YouTube channel, I assume.
It'll be on Pheasants Forever YouTube channel again on the 30th. It'll go live. There's also going to be some email communication and some communication on socials too. It's the title of the film is Careers in Conservation, and it's Saving Bob Whites in the South. So, yeah, really excited about it. I hope everybody goes and tunes in.
Cool. We mentioned the Mark Parman books. Anything else? Any other books? What have you read recently that anything stands out that you really enjoyed, whether it's hunting related or not?
So I have been, like I said, working my way through A Hunter's Road, which is absolutely incredible. I really, really have appreciated the writing is so much richer than what I originally thought it would be. I hate to say this, I did the traditional kind of judge the book by the cover, and yeah, there's a lot more meat there on the bone than what I had originally thought it would be. Right now, that's kind of been the number one thing that I've been kind of digging into. I'm getting into the time of year where reading has been a little bit more challenging for me. So, definitely would recommend it though. It was, it's an incredible read.
Love it. I read that book maybe a handful of years ago. I know that's one of Bob St. Pierre's. Well, it's many people's. It's a very commonly recommended book in the hunting space, and I would echo that. It was different. I had a maybe some vague idea of what it was. And then I read it and it was not what I was quite expecting it to be. But I definitely have a copy of that on the bookshelf. As I mentioned, I'm making my way through Harmon's book, and I'm not reading a ton of stuff right now, but I have a growing list of books that I want to read, and reading it will come and go for me at times just based on how busy I am, but I always want to sort of carve out more time, and there's too many good books to read, so I'm trying to ask people for their common recommend or recent recommendations.
And yes, I totally agree. I'm very much the same. Another one then that I did just finish, I cheated, and I'm from the enough in the new generation where an audiobook to me isn't all the way cheating.
Yes.
But Jim Harrison, The Search for the Genuine.
Okay.
I would highly recommend it. Jim Harrison is a writer that I really, really respect and has a fascinating life. It's kind of a collection. The Search for the Genuine is a collection of short stories. There's a lot of hunting and fishing based around these ones, but also learning some background on his life. It's a fantastic read. One I would definitely recommend. Probably a book that stands out the most to me of one that I've read in the last couple of years. So highly recommend it.
What do you listen to your audiobooks on? Audible?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. The Search for the Genuine, Jim Harrison.
Yeah. I mix in some audiobooks as well. I usually kind of have, like, I try to have a physical book or two that I'm reading, and then I have an audiobook that I'm listening to. And I listen to lots of podcasts and stuff too, but.
Yeah, I'm there with you.
We're in an overwhelming state of, you know, content. There's so much, and there's so much great stuff. I mean, it's just, you don't have time to listen to or read it all, but you're usually never at a loss for something new to dive into, so that's a good problem.
That's the truth. And you know, again, it goes back to the conversation of opportunity, right? There is a ton of opportunity out there, and sometimes a person has to learn how to put their filter on, and we only have so much capacity or bandwidth to be able to take it all in, that's for sure. But there is some incredible stuff out there. I agree.
What are the odds right now that you go turkey hunting with Seth, or are you just going to take the dogs for a hike and go fishing instead?
Looking at the weather, it's looking like next week. He's very convincing, and Seth is such an intelligent guy. I am so honored to be able to call him a friend. He's highly intelligent and thoughtful and just a wonderful human being, but his passion, and I don't even know if he does it on purpose, but his passion for turkey hunting is infectious. So even he's been putting out some videos on YouTube and like just doing a really beautiful job with them. And sometimes I feel like he's talking to me in them. You know, he said he had one come out the other day that was talking about how he doesn't understand how, or maybe not doesn't understand, but was trying to advocate for the fact of getting out in the spring and all the wonder that you get to see and being part of not just turkey hunting. And I was like, I wrote him after that. I'm like, I feel like you were yelling at me. He just laughed, you know? So I think it's going to be, there's a pretty high probability. I'm hoping the weather looks like it's going to cooperate. Hopefully I can carve out some time next week to get up there once we start getting too far into May. From what I'm learning from Seth too, it kind of changes some things on turkey behavior and then, yep. You know, life stuff too. He's a very busy guy, and I don't want to bother him, but I'm hoping that I can get up there. So we'll just see what happens.
Yeah. I love it. Well, I hope you can find the time, and I hope you guys can go. I will hopefully be out there too. So we'll be out there together, buddy.
That'll be fantastic. Well, I'm excited to see more video and to hear more stories. And it's always an honor to get to visit with you, whether we do it officially recording like this or just through a phone call. I appreciate you very much.
Yeah. Yeah, no doubt. Yeah. I think I did see a reel from Seth on Instagram, and it was about that, talking about just like how cool it is to be out there in the spring. And I think I had it on an episode with somebody, that same conversation where, you know, as a newish turkey hunter, just sort of wrapping my head around the experience, just having that reason to get out in the woods that time of year at the crack of dawn. I mean, that in and of itself is worth it. Setting the alarm clock that early. So I'm kind of excited about it.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. You know, like I said, the big game space really held a lot of my attention in my early life, and I've been fortunate enough to chase a lot of bears. So like springtime endeavor, that was always my thing, was to go bear hunting. And sure, I definitely do miss some of that. I haven't bear hunted in a few years. I think the last one I did actually with Nate Akey, and he took some great photos of that. But I'm at a spot in my life where I really enjoy going out and finding them, and but I don't really care to shoot another bear, and just really been fishing a ton in the spring, and then trying to incorporate some dog work. But we're at a time now too where it's kind of the quiet season for us too, and there's a little bit of lull. The smallmouth have been spawning, so I've been able to get some of those on the fly rod, and that's been a lot of fun as of late. But the mountains are definitely calling to me a little bit, so we'll see. Hopefully we can get up there.
Excellent. All right, buddy. Just in case we missed it, where would you direct folks, Journey to Conservation Careers, some of the other main things that you're working on, where do they go?
Yeah, so you can find out all the information about all the programs that are under conservation leadership at www.pheasantsforever.org and then /J2CC. That's Journey to Conservation Careers. So people can reach directly out to me from there if you have any questions, concerns. My email address too is lday@pheasantsforever.org. Feel free to reach out to me there if you have any questions or if there's anything I can do to get you started on your journey.
Excellent. Appreciate you, buddy, and everybody that you work with at Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. Keep up the great work, and thanks for taking some time to join us on another episode of Birdshot Podcast, buddy.
Yeah, it means a ton to me. Thanks a bunch for having me on, Mick. And if anybody wants to reach out personally, they can find me on Instagram too at Backcountry Levi. So happy to take questions there as well. But it's always an honor to get on here with you. And it's unfortunate. It seems like this is where we get the bulk of our time to be able to visit, because I always enjoy my time with you, buddy. So thank you for having me on. It's an honor.
Yeah, likewise, my friend. Thank you again, and we'll talk soon, all right?
All right, sounds good, buddy.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Birdshot Podcast presented by Onyx Hunt, Final Rise, and Upland Gun Company. Don't forget to rate, review, subscribe, and share. And if you really love the show and want to contribute above and beyond what you already do by listening, you can sign up at patreon.com/birdshot. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you on the next episode of the Birdshot Podcast.